All right, good morning. I think we'll get started. Our first session of the day. Good morning. My pleasure to welcome you to the 15th annual CIBC Institutional Investor Conference here in Montreal. For those of you I do not know, my name is Bob Beck, and I'm CIBC's Cable, Telecom, and Media Analyst. And so welcome, and thank you for joining us today. First out of the gate, we have one of Canada's largest companies, so I'm sure all of you know it, Bell Canada Enterprises. And joining us again this year is Glen LeBlanc, who is Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. Thank you for joining us, Glen.
My pleasure, Bob.
It's been a few years we've done this now, so I think it's...
been a couple, yes.
maybe just a good general point to get started. Obviously, it's been a very busy few years for BCE, and you know you're a year plus into catching up, running full speed with them. So maybe just a bit of a discussion on the priorities, you know, the kind of the active files you guys have got going and kind of where we can... kind of see the general theme for BC in the next year?
Sure. Yeah, 2016 certainly has been a busy year. Most recently, the Q9, a little tuck-in that we did, and then if we go to the larger acquisition earlier this year with MTS, I mean, that file still remains active. Not much to update you on there, Bob. We suspect late 2016, early 2017 close. We've made the necessary filings with the regulatory bodies, and we think we've put a remedy in front of government that certainly will meet the expectations. I think often it's spoken about the fourth wireless carrier and the elimination of such, but I think it's not well known that in the province of Manitoba there really was four players in the key urban centers such as Winnipeg, but in the rest of the province there really was only two carriers. And the proposal that we have proposed now is really going to allow for three equal players throughout the province of Manitoba, and we think that's attractive. So we'll see. That file remains open. As far as other priorities in 2016, it's been on the wireline side, it's been a real focus on fiber, bringing fiber deeper and deeper into our networks, closer to our customers. We're at about 2.6 million homes covered with fiber to the prem now. We'll see that reach about 3 million by the end of this calendar year. And when you think about a footprint for us, that's about 10.5 to 11 million homes. And ideally, you'd like to see that continue to advance towards 8 to 9 million homes. So we've got an 8 to 10 year build out in front of us, but going extremely well. Focus right now is in 416, the area code of Toronto. So building out there, that's gone very well. On the wireless side, priority continues to be network investment. About 97-98% of our customers have access to LTE, and as of today about 50% of our customers have access to an LTE advanced network, and we'll see that grow to towards 75% by the end of the year. And you know, what does that do for us? The theoretical speed limits of 335 megabits per second on an LTE advanced network, and what LTE advanced is taking advantage of bringing multi bands of spectrum together, carrier aggregation, PCS, AWS-1, 700 spectrum together. And although you get theoretical speeds of 335 megabits per second, you're seeing practical speeds of 25 to 75. So just phenomenal speeds. So that has been a priority of ours, and certainly we think a competitive differentiator for us in that space. And then on our media business, media, I don't want to overstate it, it represents a small piece of the EBITDA of our company, about 8%. That said, it's important for it to be a contributor on EBITDA and free cash flow, and that's the focus there. Continue to scale our SVOD Crave TV business and ensure that our media business continues to be a positive contributor. So those are our priorities, and I'd have to say, looking at the financial performance of our organization in the first two quarters, very pleased with our execution.
Yeah, no doubt. That gives us a lot to kind of dig into. I will remind you, anybody have a question along the way, just please throw up your hand. We can handle them. And at the end, obviously, I'll leave some time for questions as well. So just wanted to get that out there. I guess wireless is the best place to dig in. It's been a great area of success for BC for the last couple of years, for sure.
Yes.
Maybe just a general market question to start off with. Q2 was a really fabulous loading quarter for everybody. BC had a great quarter, but as did your competitors, your peers. Any thoughts on kind of that very strong subscriber penetration gain in the quarter, given where we are in the maturity cycle?
No, it was a good quarter for everybody. It was in line with our expectations for the loadings we have. Now, more of a I would say, Bob, what you're alluding to is more of an equal balance on the net adds that we've seen in the quarter than what we've seen in previous quarters. Our focus continues to be profitable net add growth. And despite the fact that the loadings were fairly equal across the large incumbents, I think you know where we're differentiating ourselves is getting a disproportionate share of the EBITDA growth that's occurring in the industry. 7.7% EBITDA growth for us in the quarter is just exceptional. We continue to have strong ARPU growth, 2.9% we were able to generate. So those are the numbers that are leading the industry. And I think what you're seeing for the upcoming quarter, you know, it's back to school, so you'll see some additional loading activity. But the focus remains for us to get our fair share of the net loadings while getting a disproportionate share of the revenue and the EBITDA and ultimately leading the pack in ARPU.
It's certainly worked for you the last couple of years. So just on that, more on that competitive theme, have you seen any disruption of late on the transfer of ownership from Wind to Shaw? Is the market at all different from a competitive standpoint since they've taken over?
No, I would say we haven't seen any activity that surprised us to date. It's very much a lot of the same. I know they're trying to digest that acquisition and understand what their path is forward. The challenge in that business is, you know, ARPUs of $37, $38 are difficult to make money.
Right.
So how do you move up the ARPU food chain? You know, and I think that's going to be a challenge for them, and they've made remarks that ultimately that's their plan. All at the same time, when you have a bit of deficiency in network, because just as they make the investments in LTE, I spoke earlier about our investments in LTE Advanced. So how do you try to match, you know, the ARPU growth that we're enjoying when you have some network inferiority? Mm-hmm. But for us, we haven't seen any disruption to speak of in the marketplace.
So you talked about your ARPU strength, 2.9%, still leading the pack. And now, on an absolute basis, I guess you've caught up to everybody and gone past. And so that was the thesis for a few years, the catch-up at BC. How much longer do you think you can sort of, kind of put out this outsized growth relative to peers? I mean, the catch-up is done, right? So
yeah.
It's a question of really over-executing at this point. Do you think you still have some runway there?
We absolutely do, Bob. We think there's quite a bit of runway still left with ARPU. And it really comes from data consumption. And if you look at what's happening, and I spoke about the evolution of LTE to LTE Advanced, and right now about 76% of our postpaid subscriber base is on our LTE network. Mm-hmm. But as a customer goes from our HSPA network over to our LTE network, we're starting to see a 40 to 50% increase in data consumption. And that data consumption just is not slowing. More and more data is being consumed on our networks every day, and that is a great opportunity for us to monetize, because you're not seeing unlimited data plans here in Canada. The three of us, the large incumbents, continue to find a way to monetize that consumption and increase bandwidth and usage. So for us, I think there's ARPU growth. 2015 was a bit of an anomaly. We had kind of a perfect storm from the data growth to the conversion from three-year to two-year contracts that we were able to see ARPU growth in the 5, 6, and 7% range. And certainly think that we'll be inside of that, more like what we enjoyed in the previous quarter of 2.9. So the low single digits ARPU growth is still in front of us. So, no, I'm excited to look ahead, because I think that'll continue for some quarters, Bob.
Do you think the market can continue to stay away from an unlimited offering and really price for usage? Do you think
certainly hope so.
And I know you hope so. But is it doable, you think?
We do. We think that the large incumbents are all looking for the same thing, which is ARPU growth, and that's a great opportunity to monetize. So I think nobody is rushing to go in that direction.
Just kind of tie that to some regulatory. We've had, you know, obviously ups and downs over the last couple of years, fairly benign right now. But the one file that's still somewhat open is the wholesale roaming from a data perspective as well. So I guess that ties to the prior question. Do you have any concern that the government's going to be unreasonable as they pursue that file?
Well, look, we expect the final decision on that to come down late 16, early 17. I think it's important to remember what a small piece wholesale roaming represents of our revenues. So am I concerned about it? No. I don't know which direction it's going to go in. Right now, what we have interim rates in place. I don't know if the final cost-based rates are going to be materially different than that. What we do know is that the rates will be separate for each of the incumbents. It won't be one rate.
Mm-hmm.
It'll be individual rates based on our filings. Will it be a retroactive decision or a go-forward decision is yet to be seen, but frankly, it's not going to be overly material, Bob.
Okay. So you talked about some of the network strength with the LTE and the LTE Advanced. Where does your spectrum position play into this? Obviously, it's part of that, the efficient use of all your spectrum holdings
mm-hmm.
that plays to those speeds. But just in general, what your thoughts on your positioning within with your spectrum ownership?
We're very pleased with our ownership position in spectrum. We have about 135 on a weighted average basis, about 135 megahertz per pop average
mm-hmm.
across. So that's a great position for us. We certainly don't feel the need for additional spectrum right now to be deployed. I think on the horizon, everyone's watching the 600
mm-hmm.
spectrum in the U.S. Of course, when that occurs here in Canada, which we still think is a couple of years out. BC will be there. We'll be participating. But we have all of the necessary spectrum we require today.
Okay. Another topic that continues to pop up in the U.S. market increasingly as well is the use of Wi-Fi as a sort of a backup, backstop, additional
to the wireless
network, a fixed wireless component.
Sure.
We'll maybe update us on BC's thoughts on that as an augment to the network, perhaps.
There's certainly a lot of talk right now about 5G and how you're going to be able to utilize 5G from a fixed wireless perspective. We think this is a number of years out. 5G standards haven't been set yet. In all likelihood, before the first commercial applications of it, we think you'll see is in 2020 Summer Olympics
mm-hmm.
in Tokyo. So it's a number of years out. Is it, the talk is 5G going to be able to serve the fixed wireline needs?
Mm-hmm.
I think on the periphery, this is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But does it make us question our fiber to the home investment today? Absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
In urban centers, as we're plowing out fiber to 3 million homes, and as I mentioned, ultimately to mm-hmm. 8 or 9 million homes, there's no doubt in my mind we're building the copper network for the next 100 years with our
mm-hmm.
fiber network.
Mm-hmm.
And we need that next 100 years technology that right now is future-proof. It's allowing enormous amounts of bandwidth pushed through. But what's exciting for me is when you think about the evolution of 5G and as the standards get set, could that be the solution for the last 2 million homes?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe so. Could that be the solution maybe to the last 3 or 4 million
right.
homes? But I think for the next 3 or 4 years, pedal to the metal on fiber investment and bringing fiber closer.
So just tying that to CapEx, obviously then you've got the continuing this fiber build.
Mm-hmm.
One would expect that the CapEx profile would be very similar for the next few years from a...
It certainly will. I mean, we've said numerous times the 17 to 17.5% capital intensity for our business will continue. We spend, almost $4 billion a year. The fiber investment onto itself is about $1
billion mm-hmm.
with both construction and demand capital built into that. I that's about 600,000 or 700,000 homes a year. I'd love to go faster. Nothing would make me happier than to wake up in the morning and wave a wand and be able to complete the fiber program at a faster pace. But I think this balance of fitting it into a responsible capital spending envelope, it's about as fast as our engineers think they can construct
right.
it anyway with resource constraint and just the permits that are required. And it's heavy lifting. So capital, you won't see it come down. We think we can manage it inside of that envelope over the next number of years.
Got a few more wireless questions. Just I'll throw it to the audience at this point if anybody has a specific question. Yes? If I could just repeat the question.
Yes,
so
please.
It's just asking again about the Wind-Shaw dynamic and whether future set-asides in spectrums might come into play and whether that can play a role in the MTS transaction as well.
I'm not going to speculate on where the regulator is going to go. That wouldn't be appropriate. We'll respect whatever decision they make on remedy. As far as future spectrum set-asides, I'm challenged to think that the government would start offering free spectrum to large incumbents, and that's what they are. Shaw is a large cable incumbent out there, so it's hard for me to fathom to think that the government is going to give away free spectrum to them while forcing the other large incumbents to pay the prices that we have. So I mean, we'll see.
Just wanted to touch on some of the economics within the wireless, cost of retention, cost of acquisition. You know, we obviously focus more cost of retention these days as maturities kick in. But your thoughts on the trends there, and I guess segue that to a discussion on the iPhone 7. You know, we've seen iPhone effect many times over over the last sort of 10 years. Your thoughts on it anecdotally for what you're seeing at Bell?
Yeah, cost of acquisition or cost of retention tends to ebb and flow. We went through a period of time in 2015 and into 2016 where we went through what we call in the industry the double cohort with so many of the two-year and three-year contracts expiring at the same time. And what that resulted in was a heightened level of retention spend. We've seen that come back down lately, Bob.
Yep.
We're in, you know, 12.9% this time last year for us is running around 11.9% for us this year. And that really is the lapping of the double cohort and a little bit more, I guess, rational pace of spend on that front. Mm-hmm. And then, but what we're now seeing shift is a little bit of an escalation on cost of acquisition spend, which occurs when you start to get these more expensive handsets into the market, like the iPhone 7, and your handset mix starts to skew a bit. So you're seeing a bit there. No one's in a better position to afford this than BC with the, you know, EBITDA generation we're having in the business. As I mentioned earlier, 7.7% EBITDA in the second quarter, so nobody can fund this better than we can. It's been manageable. I think the number of, you know, iPhone 7 devices that have come into Canada to date are limited.
Right.
So, yeah. I don't want to overstate that. It's limited at that at this point, but that will continue because we're entering into, you know, into the seasonal time right now where sales tend to escalate. And, you know, from back to school, we'll go right into Black Friday and then right into Boxing Day sales.
Right.
So I think you'll see a continued heightened COA through the remainder of the year.
Okay. Just flowing that through on the economics of handset subsidies. So, you know, the U.S. has moved away from a subsidy contract model. We've got, you know, sort of a realigned system here in Canada, more on a device balance. Your thoughts on the longer term model that might be at play here, whether you see Canada getting away from the subsidy as the U.S. has?
Yeah, ideally, no, and I think that's certain a position that no one's going to run too fast.
Yeah.
The U.S., totally different landscape with disruptors in the market like T-Mobile and even Apple themselves. We think it's a healthier landscape this way. What ends up happening is consumers tend to hang on to their handsets a little longer when there's a purchasing decision that's in front of them. If you're going to walk into the store and it's going to be a $299 or $399 or $499 upfront cost to you, cash flow on your back, then it tends to drive a longer handset hold time for the consumer. I think that's healthier. It's not using my cash flow.
Mm-hmm.
But the subsidy model really allows us to amortize the cost of the handset over a reasonable time horizon and recover our costs. But the whole cash flow is not on my back.
Mm-hmm.
I think it makes for a better barrier to entry for the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
What happens in the installment plan, which is synonymous to the automobile business when they move to leasing, is you get constant and frequent renewal.
Right.
Every 24 months, people are moving to the newest handset, and that can be quite costly for the industry. So for us, we won't lead it. We'll be a fast follower if the industry goes there. Never say never, but a different landscape in Canada where we don't have the large disruptor.
Okay. Just one last wireless question. You know, again, your outsized performance goes up against a market where essentially very similar product offerings across your big competitors. Now, how do you look at differentiating? What can drive that outsized performance when you've got the competitors? You know, similar pricing, similar offers, similar speeds. Is it the network we talked about earlier?
I truly think it is. I think our network absolutely differentiates us. Two recent independent analysts have written that BC's network is the fastest network in the country, and I mentioned the speeds that we're able to offer right now. When you look at the network advantages we have, our network sharing agreement with TELUS is truly advantageous for us. It allows us to have the best network coast to coast while enjoying cost benefits of that. You know, our CapEx year after year is about 3 basis points lower than our largest competitor. And that's from taking advantage of this national network sharing agreement that we have. Our strong brand, our network leadership position, our retail distribution that we have that's extraordinary and utilizing that retail network, the retail distribution network that we have, I think, you know, is the differentiator for us, and it's proving out in our results. I think they speak for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to move on to wireline, but first, just again, throw it out to the audience. Any lingering wireless questions at all out there? Okay, I had a number of fiber questions. I think we've touched on most of them from your fiber goals and plans, but maybe just on competition, your thoughts on the wireline perspective. Feels a bit more competitive, balanced, but competitive. I guess one of your main competitor in Ontario is been a bit more aggressive as far as some internet offerings go. Mm-hmm. So maybe just some general thoughts on the competitive dynamic, and then maybe even Quebec just to differentiate from Ontario.
Yeah, the competitive dynamic really is always intense, Bob. It moves around from geography to geography, from region to region, and it tends to be in areas where our competitors are trying to be preemptive and strike prior to our construction of fiber.
Right.
You're seeing long-term offers in the market that we're trying to avoid matching, like $99 for two-year guaranteed price points. That's not a promotion. That's a permanent price in my eyes. The average consumer doesn't remember that they were on a promotion 24 months later.
True.
So we're trying to avoid that. At times we're left with no choice but matching, but our desire would be to shorter-term promotional periods. When we come in with superior product offerings, when we do have our fiber to the node or fiber to the home network in the areas, I think we're able to compete on product attribute better. And in that instance, we don't have to offer these deep discounts. Mm-hmm. Consumers are loving our Fibe TV and all of the new applications that affords, coupled with the tremendous speeds that we have on the internet side mm-hmm. of things, and we're now rolling out new products, wireless 4K TV set-top boxes,
right.
Home hubs. So
yep.
we think we can compete on the product attribute side. That said, the market tends to be competitive. We've seen it in Ontario in specific areas, and mm-hmm. we're seeing it here in Quebec with Videotron for certain. That they tended to compete on price.
Mm-hmm.
We've done more matching lately here in Quebec. And it gets more difficult for a Videotron because, let's be honest, they're not a new-to-market disruptor anymore. They're now, in many regards, an incumbent themselves.
Right.
So you have to be careful with the aggressive pricing or you're going to reprice your own base.
You mentioned in passing some of this technology. I wanted to kind of circle back to kind of maybe dig in a bit. The home hub, for instance, I know you and I talked about this
mm-hmm.
last week on some of the potential to really remove the number of devices in the home and some of the efficiencies that might come down the road. Maybe just a quick touch on
sure.
what this is.
Sure, really excited about the home hub 3000. And to back up, for a consumer experience on the internet, it really comes down to what's your weakest link for enjoying ultimately the fiber bandwidth that you can get to. So the fact that we can deliver a gig to your ONT or your garage,
mm-hmm.
but your Wi-Fi network inside of your home is your biggest bottleneck, then
right.
customers have a difficult time differentiating that. So what we've really put a focus in now is ensuring that the home Wi-Fi experience is exceptional. Home Hub 3000 that we launched on August 29th has three radios in it, three times what it once had, and it has 12 antennas. It's three times more powerful than anything that we've had before. It's the most powerful home Wi-Fi that we know on the market. So that, we think, is a game changer
mm-hmm.
for improving the in-home experience. And then the second product that we launched this week was, and then I'll go back to the installation experience. It brought five pieces of equipment that we were required to install in a fiber installation into one box.
Mm-hmm.
So, from a customer experience perspective, it's materially better, but from a costing perspective, it's reduced the time of installation for our technicians. It's much simpler. So we're excited about the cost savings as well as the customer experience. Inside of the home, we've launched 4K wireless TV from all set-top boxes now. At one time, we've had wireless set-top boxes for a while, but we had to install the first box in your home had to be wired,
mm-hmm.
and we could daisy chain the rest of them
right.
wirelessly. Now, the entire installation is wireless. less disruptive to the customer, great flexibility to where you want to watch TV or move TVs in your home, and reduced installation time for our technicians even further. So when I think out of the future and the evolution of these of technology, I think about a fiber install, and I even think about as fiber becomes a larger part of our footprint, leaving less in place. So today, if I move out of my home, Bob, and you move in, the likelihood is I'm going to have to roll a truck to connect that.
Right.
We're now putting fiber jacks in the home, which is the next evolution of technology that will allow me to do a self-install. We can mail, as I move into your home, we can mail me the Home Hub 3000. We can mail the 4K set-top boxes. You literally plug it in, no different than an old phone jack that you had in your home for many, many years, to a fiber jack. And you pair your set-top box. It's no different than you paired your phone to your car this morning.
Mm-hmm.
So the simplicity is going to allow for self-install. And I'm excited. I don't want to imply that that's going to be 12 months when we start to see that. But when you get out to a footprint that's 5 or 6 million homes, you can really see how this is going to change the maintenance and the install costs of the future.
Okay. Any wireline questions? Take a pause. No. Just to kind of continue on the theme on the internet. So I guess I asked the question on wireless about unlimited. We are seeing those plans from a wired perspective in some markets. Your thoughts on the longer term trends for that element of pricing on wired broadband? Do you think the unlimited will ultimately be the norm, or will be just a pay for usage?
Well, it's still pay for usage, as you know now, and I think that continues for some time. And it goes back to the comment I made earlier about just the explosion in bandwidth usage and the number of connected devices in the home. If you fast forward a number of years, we're right now, the average home has 12 to 15 connected devices. I think if you look out to the future, we can see 40, 50 devices connected in the home, with everything from appliances, your television and multiple screens in the home all being connected. That's driving an incredible need for bandwidth into the home. And I think the consumers are prepared to pay for that. Mm-hmm. And when we think about the average home today, you have a teenager in your home, if you gave them a choice, food or internet, I'm not 100% sure what their answer would be, but that gives us great pricing power, because it is a product in demand. And I know in my own home, the internet better be working, or my life's not worth living.
I know that.
So we've got a couple minutes to go. I've got a couple of questions to go, but one last thing out there. No. Okay. Just I think tying it back to you mentioned EBITDA as a key strength. Free cash flow obviously is a key focus for BC. Your thoughts on the priorities for free cash flow, and again, if you could tie it perhaps to the balance sheet where it stands today. You've obviously been quite active on the M&A front as well, and so maybe your thoughts on priorities there.
Sure. It's no surprise that BC's focus is that of a dividend growth model. We know what investors expect of us, a dependent, predictable, consistent dividend increase. But in my opinion, it has to be done in a balanced manner. It has to be done in a responsible manner inside of our stated objective of a 65 to 75% free cash flow payout. You can't be raising your dividend on the back of your investment needs. And I mentioned earlier, we're committed to a 17 to 17.5% capital intensity. So, can't fund your dividend by cutting your capital program. And ultimately, you can't fund your dividend growth model on the back of your balance sheet and rising leverage. So for me, it's the three-legged stool. It's the appropriate balance of ensure that you're raising your dividend but inside a responsible payout ratio. Invest in the technology the company needs to be vibrant into the future. And be respectful of the balance sheet and the desire for us to remain and maintain our investment grade credit ratings as we have. Mm-hmm. We've shown that we generate $800 to $1 billion of excess free cash flow per year. We'll use that cash flow for paying down debt and getting inside of our stated leverage ratio range of about 2.25. Strategic acquisitions when they make sense for us. Mm-hmm. Funding pension if that interest rates continue low. That's something that we have to be cognizant of. So for us, it's about balance, and I think we've demonstrated year after year that the dividend growth model is something that we can do, but in a balanced and respectful manner to the balance sheet.
Excellent. I think that's it for time. So any desperate last question? No? All right. Well, thank you very much for your interest. And, again, Glenn, thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure. Time.